Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 22 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Cindy.
And we hope everybody had a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Merry Kwanzaa, Happy Festivus, Happy Boxing Day, and a Happy New Year.
That's true.
So, and we had a very nice Christmas, a very nice New Year, very lazy post-Christmas season, which is one reason why we're kind of behind in recording this episode.
Well, that's all right.
We've enjoyed
ourselves.
Yeah, we've just been in lazy mode, so it's kind of nice after running all year long to just kind of chillax a little bit. So, but on this episode, we thought we'd kind of tie Cindy's day job and career into the passion of Supermates, which is, of course, superheroes.
That's right.
And so we're going to be talking about some children's books that featured superhero characters. These are all vintage books, but they have some analogs with modern books today, and we'll touch on that with one of them.
One of the first things I did when I took over as the children's librarian is I actually made a new category called Easy Graphic Novels, because that's where the storybooks are for superheroes. And those books get checked out like gangbusters, because they're all together instead of being spread out throughout my collection. There's a specific place where, a 2-3-year-old can have a book read to them about the superheroes. And there's a lot out on the market today that have superheroes in them, from board books and on up.
Right. It's interesting that it's a segment that the big two publishers have pretty much abandoned as a young reader.
Right.
But their slack has been picked up by companies like Capstone.
Stone, yeah.
And companies like that, which is sad that the comic companies aren't doing it themselves, but at least there is something out there for the kids to read. And, you know, that's another thing. I mean, a lot of people, when you talk about how did you get into comics, how did you, you know, when did you first meet the superheroes, you know, a lot of people will say, well, I first met them, you know, I saw them on TV. I watched the reruns of the Adam West Show. I watched reruns of the Spider-Man cartoon. I saw Spider-Man and the Electric Company,
right.
Super Friends. But I think another thing that probably everybody had at one point or another that's probably listening to this was some kind of children's book.
Right.
That featured the characters.
They didn't. I went and looked after you and I talked about doing this show as far as there being board books. Now, board books, when I say that, those are books where the pages are, you know, almost, I wouldn't say cardboard, but they're really, really thick. And you can hand a board book to a child that is barely setting up, you know, 4, 5, 6 months old, and they won't destroy it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find any that had been published before, you know, the last, say, 10 years.
Right.
And what I think's really cool is I'll have, you know, and I see this more with dads come in with this, but I have moms come in too, and they'll ask me, do you have any board books with superheroes in them? I have a new baby, and I want to read to them about what I like. And I love that they are now, you know, there's Wonder Woman books, and there's Batman counting books, and ABCs, and stuff like that, and they're in board book format. So you can start off geeking your kid out, you know, as soon as they come out. So
Right. That's great. I mean, because, you know, I think one of the early type books that featured licensed characters in comic strip and comic book characters were the Big Little books,
mm-hmm.
from Golden. They actually have a Batman Big Little book from when I was a kid that we're not going to cover it today, but and then I have a Fantastic Four one that a family friend gave me from the 60s, and those like started back in the 1930s.
Right.
You know, in fact, Bob Kane lifted some artwork for one of them in some of the early Batman comics, so they go back pretty far into the 30s. But That was, you know, probably that predates even some of the superheroes. But so there has been a stream, but I think you're right. I think they're going even younger now.
Right. Well, I think now you have publishers have woken up, and a lot of the things, what's going on is what was popular when we were little. You know, we have now grown up. We now have jobs. We're now in the position that we are controlling what's made, and we produce what we like, what we remember. That's the reason right now there's so much stuff about, say, My Little Pony, about Strawberry Shortcake, you know, that whole
Star Wars,
that whole ad campaign, the car, they have Strawberry Shortcake and He-Man and Stretch Armstrong, and
right.
You know, and the reason for that is because the kids of that generation are now the adults that are driving today's economy, and
right.
So you buy what you like, and you say, okay, I like this, and that translates into books.
Right, right. That's true, yeah. That's a good point. And in a few years from now, it'll be, and it's already starting, but it'll be Power Rangers.
Exactly. In the next 5 years or so,
yeah.
Power Rangers, you'll have a big resurgence.
And Ninja Turtles will be more, it's kind of in between He-Man and Power Rangers, and you're starting to see that more. But it'll be, and I think that's one reason why Ninja Turtles is popular again, because the parents are pushing the kids into it. They can watch it with their kids and
right, exactly,
and remember their version of it. And so, yeah, that I really like those commercials too.
I cannot remember the car company it is. I'm sorry.
It was Honda. I think it was Happy Honda Days.
Okay.
And my favorite one was Skeletor, because he was showing the backup camera, and he's like, you can keep an eye. And it kind of sounded like the old Filmation Skeletor. It's like, you can keep an eye out for trouble. And in the backup camera, you saw He-Man on Battle Cat. But
see?
I think Stretch Armstrong might have been Diedrich Bader. He sounded like
I think you're right.
That was the voice of Batman on The Brave and the Bold, so that was cool. But yeah, those were really cool commercials. Speaking of Batman, I thought we'd actually start off with, as Forrest Gump would say, my favorite book from from childhood. It's not Curious George like Forrest. It's a book that was published by Golden Press, which, you know, of course, Golden Press is the people that brought us Little Golden Books and Big Little Books and still publish children's books today. And
this book is actually featured in the 50th anniversary of Little Golden Books.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's got a little description in there. It's one of the ones they picked out.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that book came out 2 years ago about the history of Little Golden Books, and that's one of the books they show.
Cool. Well, this book was actually published in 1966, but they kept it in print
right
through the 70s, and obviously the one version I have was, I don't know what printing it was, because it's a, you know, it's a soft cover little book. It's actually in the shape of Batman's head, and it's called Batman and Robin from Alfred to Zowie.
This is an original print.
That's an original print?
Mm-hmm.
How can you tell?
Copyright 1966, and it doesn't have reissue on it.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. I guess my copy was sitting around since 1966.
Yeah.
Or something. Somehow. But anyway, it is officially credited to being told by Ruthanna Thomas, and pictures adapted by Tom Gill, which I think is kind of odd, because, I mean, there's a few Carmine Infantino swipes in here, but other than that, it looks pretty much like he just drew it from, you know, he didn't
right.
really copy anything, which is...
I'm kind of intrigued by why they say it's told by, not written by, or just by, because usually if you have something that says told by, then that means there is an audio version of this somewhere.
Hmm. I don't think, I mean,
I'm just saying usually.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's usually what that indicates, that it's maybe it started out being a book and record set or something, but I don't know that.
I don't know.
It's kind of weird.
I don't think there was a lot of book and record sets of Batman back in the 60s. I mean, that came along more, and there were, but, you know, they were more prolific during the Power Records era, which, you know, you can listen to on the Power Records podcast episodes of the Fire and Water podcast, which I'm also
involved
part of.
With,
yes,
yes,
I'm also involved with. But anyway, so we thought rather than try to synopsize this baby, I would just read it. So you can learn your alphabet with Batman, Robin, and me. So Batman and Robin from Alfred to Zowie. A is for Alfred, the Wayne Manor butler, who's never been known to complain, who answers the bat phone in courteous tones and summons his master, Bruce Wayne. B is for Bruce, who now takes the call with Dick Grayson, his ward and his chum. C is Commissioner Gordon, perplexed, who pleads for the Batman to come. And we have a nice scene of Alfred It's in the study of Wayne Manor, and Alfred is handing the bat phone to Bruce, and you've got the Shakespeare bust in the foreground, and Alfred, Bruce and Dick look like the generic comic versions, but Alfred looks like Alan Napier from the TV show, which of course this was published during Batmania, that kind
right,
of stuff, that thing.
The year of the bat.
That's right, the original year of the bat. D, down the bat pole they deftly descend, donning disguise as they slide. E, Eureka, Boy Wonder and Batman emerge ready for the Batmobile ride. And there's a shot of Batman and Robin sliding down the bat poles, although they look more like bat boards.
They look flat. Well, I think that's just where whoever the Gill guy drew it, he put the shine on it off to the side too much. It should have been more in the middle, and I think then you wouldn't have gotten the board versus pole look.
Okay, but you get a sound effect of zip as they slide down, and the Batmobile is not the TV show Barris Batmobile, but the 1964 new look Carmine Infantino with the bat head painted on the front. F is for foes so fiendishly foul, evilly biding their time. G, Gotham City, terrified now by news of a new wave of crime. H, holy hat rack, the Boy Wonder says. Can it be that the Mad Hatter's loose? While back at Wayne Manor, Aunt Harriet sighs, oh, where are Dick Grayson and Bruce? And you got the Batmobile, you know, speeding through the streets of Gotham with a big zazoom sound effect, so that's cool. I is for international crooks, those devilish dastardly thieves. J is the Joker, who deals out the tricks with Penguin, Mad Hatter, and Freeze. K is for kidnap, a hideous plot to spirit Boy Wonder from sight. L, lure the Batman to follow in search, and then disappear in the night. So we got Joker, Mad Hatter, Freeze, who's not called Mr. Freeze, and Penguin sitting around a table in the shadow, you know, a shadowy room with a light hanging over top of them. And Mr. Freeze had only appeared once in the comics as Mr. Zero and then on the TV show. So he's in his Mr. Zero costume, although it's colored differently, and he doesn't have a helmet, and he's blue. And then Mad Hatter looks like no version of the Mad Hatter ever seen before.
No.
He just looks like a guy in a top hat. He's not the Lewis Carroll looking Mad Hatter from the early comics that later came back, and he's not the Jervis Tetch mustachioed version that David Wayne played on the series that was also from the comics of the 50s. M, mobile crime watch to check and recheck, always with Batman in tune. Batman's checking the panel of instruments in the Batmobile. N is for now. Look, there's the bat sign. Bat wings for warnings. Black on the moon. It always bothered me that they didn't call it the bat signal. They call it the bat sign. I was just like, you know, I called foul even as a kid on that one.
Well, but you've got to think, when you're doing a kid's book, you want it to have a certain rhythm. And I think where signal versus sign, you've got two syllables versus one.
Mm.
And I think that's the decision there.
Okay. I'll buy that. O's Chief O'Hara, whose voice Penguin mimics. The bat line beep beeps with his call. Flash straight to Batman. Rush to the bank, sir. It's being looted, that's all. Onward and batward, the dynamic duo speeds toward the bank, never spotting the trick. P is for Penguin, disguising his voice with his get to the bank double quick. And shows the Penguin talking into a microphone device as the Batmobile goes by. So you get a Chief O'Hara reference.
Right.
But you don't actually see or hear him. You hear the Penguin doing his voice. Q is for question. Who will win out now? Creatures of crime or crusaders in cape? Will Batman and Robin foil them completely? Or will the villains strike and escape? Got a page full of question marks. Which it's like there's no Riddler in here. Which is
I know. I just kept waiting for a Riddler reference.
Yeah, it was always kind of odd. It's kind of odd that they didn't use the Riddler and used Mad Hatter and Mr. Freeze instead. R is for Robin, poor luckless laddie, snatched at the bank by the crime-ridden foe. S is for search, wherein Batman discovers that Robin is missing, and so is the doe. The Robin, they shows the crooks grabbing Robin and he looks like the Mego figure right there. I always thought
he
did.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
He's got the spit curls. In most of the book, he's got the, you know, the new look kind of combed over Burt Ward type hair. But even as a kid, I'm like, hey, that looks like my Robin doll. You know? But I didn't realize that Robin, you know, other than the cartoon opening, I didn't realize Robin had that haircut in the old comics till sometime later. So, and Batman shows Batman finding the bank vault just shredded. Looks like it had been blown up. T is for terror, rampant in Gotham. Boy Wonder is missing, and Batman hard-pressed. U is utility belt of the Batman. Now's the moment. Must pass the test. Ready the Batarang. Ready the Batrope. V are the villains at the end of the trail. Who will win out? Will the forces of evil end up in triumph or end up in jail? Shows Batman swinging on a rope, throwing his Batarang, and there's a sound effect of Zooey! W. Wayne Warehouse, where Robin is hidden, bound up securely, but never despair. For great Scott, he still has his homing transmitter, and now sends this message. Batman, beware!
Ooh, pretty good. Dick Grayson there. Yeah.
X for the X-ray scope Batman is using to see what's ahead and to outwit the mob. Bat phone to call in the police for the roundup. Bat gassing gun just to speed up the job. It shows Batman in the Batmobile, looking at this screen that shows Robin in the warehouse with Batman beware, you know. And so, you know, with technology like that, you know.
Well, yeah.
These guys don't stand a chance, you know.
I sense some sarcasm.
Yeah, why is for you who now have the pleasure of seeing brave Batman in the thick of the thieves. Z is for Zally, bang wham, and the capture of Mad Hatter, the Joker, the Penguin, and Freeze. You get Batman, like, one punch knocking the Joker into the Penguin, whose hand is knocking over the Mad Hatter and who's kicking Mr. Freeze right in the face. And you got all sorts of sound effects. Pow, whap, zowie, bam, crack. You know, very influenced by the TV show, obviously. And so to the end of our alphabet story, but always remember, as Batman would say, clean living is best, and right conquers evil, and never forget that crime doesn't pay. The end.
Very good, Adam.
Well, it just didn't sound right to say it like Christian Bale. Clean living is best. Right conquers evil. Never forget the crime doesn't pay.
What the crap did you say?
I could have said like Kevin Conroy, but I, you know. But it's Adam West Batman. So we'll do that. So, yeah. So the book itself, I think I mentioned this before, but just to reiterate, it is in the shape of Batman's head, and it's a very smiley Batman with little short ears, you know, but he's a very happy looking Batman, which, you know, nowadays you wouldn't see. I actually have a Spider-Man book similar to that, which I can't find at the moment, and a Bugs Bunny book like that. So apparently after this, they kept doing that. And I think that those are definitely from the 70s, at least, yeah. Spider-Man. And they kept doing books like that. In the scene where, at the beginning, I was talking about Alfred looks like Alan Napier. You see Bruce, he's got on his smoking jacket / robe and ascot. So he's...
I'm sorry, but that was always silly. I mean, you know, I get it. It set the tone, blah, blah, blah. But I was just like, oh, wow.
You know, that's just the way Bruce Wayne looked back then. I mean, even in the comics back then, he was always seen with that. When Thomas writes Aunt Harriet's dialogue that she's worried about Dick and Bruce, she says, oh, where are Dick Grayson and Bruce? Well, now Dick is actually her nephew, but I think a lot of people forget that and think she's Bruce's nephew, because why would you call your nephew Dick Grayson? You just call him Dick, and you might call Bruce Wayne. She's more familiar with Bruce than Dick, but Dick's her nephew.
Not meaning to poke holes at you.
Yeah.
But if you read it as far as syllables, that's the reason they put Dick Grayson.
Well, I'm sure.
But, you know, that's...
It's another thing about the whole rhyming and everything.
Well, I mean, when you're doing children's books, and I mean, this is just me coming at it from a professional standpoint, you want it to have a certain flow, a certain rhythm, so that when a child is reading, they can pick out the next word just because they're like, oh, well, it sounds like this. I bet you it's going to be this word. And that helps teach kids to read.
Loose rhymes with Bruce. Mm-hmm. Or Bruce rhymes with loose.
Right.
Right, right.
So that's the reason I think they made that particular choice.
Well, I mean, I think, though, over the years...
Now, I'm not trying to argue with you about it. I'm just, you know...
No, I think over the years, though, that the fact that Aunt Harriet is supposed to be Dick's aunt is forgotten a lot. Even in the kids were playing Lego Batman 3.
Oh, okay.
And there's a segment of it that's Batman 66, and Adam West does quite a bit of voiceover in it as well, as Batman and as Adam West. Mm-hmm. There was something I caught it just real quick while they were playing. He said something about his Aunt Harriet.
Oh.
So I think even Adam West forgot, or, you know, the writers, and then him, he forgot and said, oh, wait a minute, Aunt Harriet's not my aunt, so he didn't catch it either. So, you know, over the years, I think that's just kind of crept in, that she was introduced as Dick's aunt to, because it killed Alfred off. And, of course, every comic fan knows Aunt Harriet was not the creation of the TV series. She existed in the comic books with the new look, because it killed Alfred off to kind of, you know, make things seem not so suspect, quote-unquote, back then.
Right.
And so she was there when the TV show started, and then they wanted Alfred in there, too. So they put Alfred and Aunt Harriet. So thankfully, the comics had to bring Alfred back. I couldn't really find anything on Ruth Anna Thomas, unfortunately. But, it seems, at least, I don't know about in children's books, but in comic books back then, there were very few women working in the creative side of comic books.
Right.
I mean, you had people like Marie Severin, who will come up later, who worked at Marvel. And then you had Ramona Fraiden, of course, who worked at DC, doing Aquaman and Metamorpho. But there were very few female comic book creators at the time. So it was kind of nice to see her name in the credits. Now, the artist Tom Gill, I did some research on him. He did a lot of Western comics back in the 40s and 50s and through the 60s, including Marvel Timely Atlas Western books back when they couldn't decide what their name was. but he's most famous for an 11-year run on Dell's Lone Ranger comic. He drew it for 11 years straight, which is one of the top, records of an unbroken run in comics. He also drew some issues of the Gold Key comic based on Boris Karloff's Thriller, which is a really good TV show, if you've never seen it, by the way. But
which is available on Amazon. You can get the best of, and I got you that for Christmas last year. So.
Mm-hmm. It's got two episodes with Shatner in it, so they're really good. I mean, you got one episode that's got Shatner and Natalie Schaefer that played Mrs. Howe from Gilligan's Island. So, you've got some mixing of 60s TV icons there. So it's kind of nice. But yeah, that book, I have no idea how many times I read that book myself and then reread it to the kids. I've read it to the kids over and over again.
Yeah, this is one book that I'm not allowed to read to the kids. This is his, he's the one that does that. So.
Yeah, when it comes to the superhero stuff. Because I can do the voices, or at least to their satisfaction anyway.
Yeah.
Like Scooby-Doo.
Danny, our daughter, loves Scooby-Doo. I'm reading her, apparently my Scooby-Doo and Shaggy voice leave much to be desired. And she'll let me read it, but she always tells me, Daddy does the voices better.
She just made a face. But to me, this is as much a part of Batman to me, because it was a book I read and reread and reread, and my mom read to me, and then I read when I got old enough to read. I read it so many times, and I guess because it felt like the TV show, it was just as important to me and seminal in my idea of what Batman was as O'Neill and Adams and Englehart and Rogers. And so it is just the quintessential part of Batman for me. So that might seem kind of silly because it's a children's book, but it's still tucked away back in my head pretty deep. So I thought we'd share the love for it a little bit. The next book we're going to talk about actually came out in the 70s, and I didn't have it as a kid, but my lovely wife here gifted it with me several years back, and that is The Super Dictionary. And it was by Mark Z. Holmes, editorial director. It was a Warner Educational Services book and published by Holt, Reinhart, and Winston in 1978, I think.
Yep, 78.
So this was as the push for Superman the movie was heating up. Superman the movie came out in late, I think it was December 15th, 1978. So there was a lot of books coming out that had something to do with either Superman or the DC superheroes. Because of that, it's got a great cover by Joe Kubert, but I always thought Kubert was kind of a bit of an odd choice for the licensed material like this, because he has such a distinct style, and his style wasn't—I mean, it was his and his alone. I mean, he didn't have that the look that like a Murphy Anderson or even a Neil Adams or a Jose Luis Garcia Lopez or Dick Giordano. Would have. They did a lot of licensing work, Ross Andrew, people like that. But Kubert was kind of an odd, I mean, it's a great looking cover, but he's just, you know, it just doesn't seem, he's not the type of guy that you would think they'd go to and say, you know, your artwork's going to, you know, you're the face of DC Comics, you know.
Right.
You know, he was much more known for the war comics, and although he did do Hawkman, you know, he as far as the other superheroes, he wasn't associated with them that much. But he did artwork on the interior, too. It's kind of interesting because, I mean, this is a dictionary, and so they use the DC characters in panels and artwork from comics throughout DC's history in it. They have a super who's who that introduces the characters that you're going to see throughout the book. And, of course, you've got the obvious Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, Aquaman, Green Lantern, Adam, Hawkman, you know, Green Arrow characters like that. They also have some rather obscure characters like Comet, the Super Horse, Tomahawk, the Revolutionary War hero, and Firehair, which was a Kubert creation. And then, even stranger, they have a set of totally fabricated characters that were basically created to fill out the whites-only club that was DC at the time.
Right.
I mean, you have Conjura, who seems to be a Middle Eastern female working of Zatanna, complete with backwards spells. Jonna Crisp, who's a female space pilot with a really strange name. El Dragon, a Hispanic hero who has the power to control electricity with his brain.
Okie doke.
What? Wilson Forbes, an African-American reporter for the Daily Planet. Now, I'm not sure. He doesn't ring a bell. He could be like a background character in the Superman comics at the time,
right?
Or Lois Lane's strip or something, but he's not ringing a bell with me. If he is, somebody let us know. Jody, that's the only name they give him, an African-American replacement for Tomahawk's Dan Hunter in Revolutionary War time, which is kind of strange, but okay. SR-12, a tiny alien female, and Ted and Terry Trapper, an African-American detective team. It's really strange that they didn't, you know, at least if they were going to grab, DC did not have a very good mix of ethnic diversity in their characters.
Right.
No, back then. But they did have some. They had Mal Duncan, John Stewart, and Black Lightning had just appeared. So they could have possibly used those.
Right. What about Gypsy?
Gypsy wasn't around until the 80s.
Oh, okay. So,
Well, no, that's fine. But she debuted with the Detroit Justice League.
Gotcha.
She didn't exist before. And Vixen, right around this time, was supposed to have come out, but she didn't come out with the DC implosion. The DC explosion turned into the implosion, and her book never came out. And so she didn't appear till up in the 80s.
I just wonder if maybe, I mean, was anything ever done with any of these characters besides this?
Now, I should have put this in the notes, and I meant to, and I forgot. When I was a kid, one of the teachers in the elementary school that had been there a long time, I can't remember which one it was, but they had like a box full of this material that was DC Comics created educational material.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called like Super A, Super B. It was like set like at different levels.
Every once in a while, I've tried to look for that for you for like Christmas or birthday or whatever.
Right.
And I've come across it once or twice, but it's always like in the $200 or $300 range, and it's just too high.
No,
that I can't touch it.
I don't want it that bad.
No. And at one time, I don't know if you remember this, but when I was taking classes at Moorhead, when you and I were going to college, there was a poster in the education building featuring Superman and Batman, and it was an old one. It was just back, you know.
It was still hanging up?
Yeah. It was in the supply closet of the teaching things.
For 20 years ago, you should have grabbed it.
Well, it didn't, you know. They had a supply closet when you were doing your student teaching that you could go in and get stuff. Well, this was like in the back, and I saw it, and I was like, oh, but, you know, I can't snitch it. You could check stuff out, but that wasn't, I mean, I remember seeing that, and that was, well, let's see, we graduated in 93, that was probably in college, probably about 94 or 95.
Right.
When I was taking my teaching classes.
Well, I remember that occasionally, and I think it was when I had reading, you know, like, because sometimes at our school, you would have reading with a different teacher.
Right, RTI.
Yeah, right.
Our kids do that now.
I know. And I just explained that for people.
Oh, that don't, yeah.
That don't have that.
Sorry.
So you would, you know, your main teacher, you would have a reading with a separate teacher. It was according to, it was tracked. It was according to what your reading level was at. And so and my reading level was always high because I read comic books and I understood big words that other kids didn't. And, because of comics. And,
see, it works, folks.
Yeah, it works. Too bad you can't hand a kid a modern comic now, really. Or very few. But anyway, I remember one of those teachers pulling this out, this Super A, B. I always remember calling it Super A, but there was Super B. And it actually had some of these characters in it. I know Conjura was in it.
Mm.
And in fact, I think I saw something online a few years back where they were talking about, you know, they basically took a Zatanna tale that I think was, Zatanna had a strip in Adventure Comics. And they took a Zatanna, or Zatanna, however you want to say it. We've gotten to that before. They took a Zatanna tale and basically redrew Conjura over top of her.
Oh.
And because, you know, she had the backward spells and everything. And so those characters, I think that project probably predated this one. So maybe they pulled them from that. I'm not exactly sure the dates on that. But it was around the same time, just, you know, within a few years of each other. So it was probably involved some of the same people and some, you know, there's a educational advisory board in this book,
right,
and people that worked on it, and there's a laundry list of, and I think that's one reason why the book, when you get into the book, there's some really strange things in this book, and it's clearly handled more by people who don't know the DC characters,
mm-hmm,
than do. You know, it's like, you can just kind of imagine somebody saying, okay, here's a list of characters and what they are, and, you know, a brief description, and they're like, okay, well, you've got to use these guys. DC's like, you got to use the main guys, and then you can, here's a list of secondary characters you can use, and they're like, okay, and that's pretty much what they knew of them, other than, you know, just general, like, they probably knew of Superman and Batman,
yeah.
But there's some strange stuff going on in this book. Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
Thank you.
There's some strange recoloring going on in here. Catwoman appears in her pirate outfit like the Mego figure had, with the blue tights and the mask. But Batgirl that you see in this book is often a recolored Catwoman from her classic outfit with the purple dress. And just from the top up, they recolor her into Batgirl's colors, which is weird. And then Airwave, which I don't know if you know who Airwave is, but
no.
She's like shaking her head like, no. He was a guy that was, there was a Golden Age Airwave, and then there was a modern, or a Bronze Age Airwave, who was revealed to be Green Lantern's cousin, and he wore a green and yellow costume. Well, in here it's colored like orange and purple, which is just really strange. But to really understand the Super Dictionary, you know, we gotta give you some examples of how it works. So we'll skip around to a few things here, a few entries of that jumped out at me as I was going through it, working on notes. Like, for instance, on page 56, you have an entry for box, the word box, and it says Lois Lane has a box on her head. She has something on her head that is made of paper or wood and is used to hold things. Most boxes have four flat sides, a bottom, and a top. And the picture that they've used to illustrate this is artwork that's clearly by a classic Superman artist, Wayne Boring. And it shows Clark Kent and Perry White gaping at Lois in the foreground, who has a little, you know, little short sleeve turquoise top and little purple gloves, and she has a box on her head. Now, whether Lois really had the box on her head in the original panel, who knows? I mean, it was a Silver Age Superman comic.
Right.
Anything could happen. She could have had a bad hair day and put a box on her head. And knowing the way Silver Age comic worked, it was probably some prank Superman was playing on her to show her a lesson, you know, which, because Superman had nothing better to do than to torment his friends back then.
Yeah, let's teach the woman I love a lesson by treating her like a 2-year-old.
Right, exactly.
That's why they waited so long to get married.
Yeah. Another good one is for also in the B's is Bump on page 62. It says, Adam got a bump on his head. He got a heavy blow on the head. He could put on a hard hat so he would not get any more bumps. He had better watch out so that no one can knock into him. People bumped him anyway. And the drawing is...
I'm sorry, but the little girl looks demonic.
It's a very demonic, very Kubert, or at least Kubert school drawn little girl who has a figure of the Adam, and she's slamming his head into a table. The Adam, to me, looks like he's drawn by Jim Aparo, which shows you how they cobble together things to make up these very strange entries.
I can't help it. I keep looking at that little girl, and the theme from Damien, the Omen, keeps running through my head. Insane dog. I'm like,
Another really strange one is for the word coat. Firehair made himself a coat. He made himself something warm to wear with arms in it. In the woods, he can't buy coats. His friend the raccoon has a warm coat, too. The raccoon has a warm cover of fur on its skin. So we got this picture of Firehair, who's... I don't think Kubert drew this. His head kind of looks Kubert-y, but the proportions seem really weird.
It almost makes you think, I mean, you've got such a Joe Kubert influence. I wonder if this wasn't like a school assignment and all the different people that were at his school were like, okay, you do this page and you do this page, and it was just a compilation.
It could
of different
be.
Drawings.
I don't see that credited in here, but it would make,
I mean, that makes me think.
It
you
makes
know?
You wonder, doesn't it? It might be. They might have worked on it. Yeah, because they did the Heroes World catalogs back then. And
I mean, you know, yeah. That's just what I think. You know, just looking at it, I'm just like, I wonder if that's what happened there.
It could be, but you've got Firehair sitting in a tree. Now, he's sitting in a tree sewing a coat that's like an orangey pink. And next to him is a pink raccoon.
I've seen that. I saw one last night.
What the heck?
Such a natural state of things.
What the heck were you drinking? Page 100, Lois Lane gets her revenge for the whole box thing, if Superman did do that to her. The word decide. Lois has a word balloon that says, decide if you want to drive or fly, Superman. Make up your mind which it will be. When you have decided, I'll tell you where you have to go. The picture is probably from some bat crap crazy Lois Lane comic of the 70s. Mm. She is standing over a Superman who's in the floor, and he's kind of smiling nervously at Lois as she has him by the shirt with her fist back like she's shaking, like she's getting ready to whop Superman. Now, this is what they put in this book for the word decide.
It's kind of like, hmm.
Mm-hmm. Another good Superman's getting he's getting a lot of crap in this book. Jump to page 256, and there's an entry for paint and painting, which is kind of combined, and with one panel. It says, paint. Lex Luthor put gold paint on Superman. He put a wet gold coating on him. He had more paints. Lex wanted to paint a picture. He wanted to make a picture using paint. He had painted Superman, too. And then painting. The word balloon Lex has says, what a great painting. What a great picture. All Superman paintings are wonderful. It is a panel that looks like it probably originated with Kurt Swan of Superman chained to the wall via kryptonite chains. And Lex is painting him with orange paint. Superman is covered in orange paint.
Well, you know.
Orange and gold paint. It's just bizarre. Then we get to the word tape on page 356. This is one that's kind of in the department nowadays. Kind of reads really weird. Tape. We have a panel of the Joker. The Joker's from the Laughing Fish storyline drawn by Marshall Rogers. I can tell you that. Supergirl looks like she's by Bob Ostner or somebody. She's in her hot pants outfit. And it says, the Joker says, this tape will hold you. This sticky strip will hold you. I have lots of tapes for you. I'll tape you to the chair. I'll stick you to the chair. And there's a chair in the background. Supergirl says, go ahead. I've been taped before, and I've always gotten away. Now, I don't know what these two are doing in their spare time. But we'll try to keep this episode kid-friendly. But, yeah, that was the entry for tape. So I'll just leave it up to you to, you know, think about
make
that.
Make your own conjecture.
Yeah,
about that.
Yeah, you, yeah. And actually, on page 358, we have tear. It says, a tear ran down Green Arrow's cheek. A drop of water from his eye ran down his cheek. Then he cried many tears. He cried because he saw a child tear a painting he had made for Black Canary. He saw the child pull apart the painting. Green Arrow doesn't know why he tore it. No one had ever torn a painting of his before. So they've taken the word tear and the word tear, because they're spelled exactly the same,
right,
and put them together. The weird thing about this is it's a very super realistic panel of Green Arrow by Neil Adams.
Right.
From, you know, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow run, and he has tears running down his face. But they, you know, he's crying like that because somebody tore his painting, not because of some social injustice, you know, which is weird. So that's just some examples of how odd this book is. And I'm sure a lot of kids had this and learned a lot of words. And, of course, they love just looking through and seeing the pictures, which is why I like it. It was, you know, it came out at a very odd time in DC's history. Carmine Infantino had just basically been booted out. Jeanette Kahn was coming in as I think she came in as publisher first, but you still had Saul Harrison was the president. So it was kind of at an in-between phase of those two famous regimes in DC history. So that might be one reason why it's kind of odd, because Jeanette Kahn seemed to have more of an actual input. Like the superhero cookbook that came out in the 80s was a lot more cohesive and felt like a more legit DC thing than this. You know, there's a new book that just came out that Danny got for Christmas, mm-hmm, called the DC Superheroes My First Dictionary book. But it's a lot more straightforward.
But it's also a lot shorter, too.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
This is a total of 128 pages, whereas that one's up in the 300s.
Right. It's 416 pages.
Oh, 416 pages.
Right.
So they picked the very best for this book.
Right. This book actually, I think, really tries to be a true dictionary, mm-hmm, for kids, whereas this one's more just like a basic dictionary. Like, one thing that, like, the actual characters have entries in it, you know, by their name. Like, there's an entry for Aquaman on page 9 that says, Aquaman can talk to sea creatures and swim like one, too. You know, things like that. The other words are pulled more directly from the actual comic art, like Melt on page 69.
And this book, this the one that Christopher and I are talking about right now, it's available right now. It just got published, mm-hmm, in 2014, so you can pick it up.
Right.
So it's really cool. It's got a lot of, even though he's not credited for some reason, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
The artwork is clearly from him, but he's actually not credited for this.
I think it's weird because artists are credited because it pulls not only from the famous DC style guide, which Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, of course, contributed to the vast majority of that artwork for the past 30 years. I think that's the reason why they're not. He's not, because he was paid, I guess, maybe for this being used in licensing, mm-hmm, whereas the others weren't, so they had to be credited.
Well, and see, the board books that I was talking about at the beginning,
mm-hmm,
that's all based on Jose Luis Garcia Lopez art, too.
Right, praise be his name. But, like, the word melt on page 69, it says, melt. When Superman forgets to turn off his heat vision, his glasses get too hot and melt. This is panel is Clark Kent with his glasses melting. It's pulled from that John Byrne comic. I can't think of the name. The John Byrne Superman comic where Superman's powers go out of whack. And I think it's, this is probably wrong. It's like Superman number 9 from Byrne's run. I that's off the top of my head. I have no idea if that's right. But I know that's what the panel's from. So that's just a for instance how this version of the book works. And it's written by a guy named Michael Robin and published by Downtown Bookworks. So you can go out to Amazon and find this one now. If you got kids or nephews or grandkids or whatever, and they like superheroes or you like superheroes and want them to like them too, this would be a good way to get them started on it. So I'd recommend that one. And there's also other great books out there. Like there's a series of DC Super Pets books,
mm-hmm,
which are by Art Balthazar, does the artwork.
I have a ton of those, and those are released by Capstone. You can get those on Amazon. Great set of books. And he actually does, there's levelized readers, which what that means is the Art Balthazar books, they have them where they have them for itty bitties, which would have like maybe 4 or 5 words on a page, or a level one. They have level two reader. They have 2, 3, 4. I think they go up when they start getting into 4, they start doing chapter books, and they're based on the Art Balthazar universe.
Right. And then they've got a book that's the DC Super Pets Encyclopedia,
mm-hmm.
which is a great book that's got all the different, some of them are made up for this book series, but it's like got all the animal sidekicks of the heroes and the villains, mm-hmm. and it's got entries for the superheroes as well. So if you like Art's work, Art Balthazar and Franco's work on like Tiny Titans, and they're all yeah comics, then you can, if you get this book, you can see how they'd handle all the DC characters.
Right.
So it's really cool in that style, and you're like, why don't they make a cartoon of this?
I know exactly.
I know they did some shorts actually on Cartoon Network that were the Super Pets, but right. They should be a series of this.
Hint, hint, DC.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, they're listening to this, especially after I give them a hard time all the time. But anyway. But I think Capstone does, or they did until recently, animated series books too, right? That are mm-hmm. set in the animated universe right. with the Bruce Timm style.
They're actually still available. A lot of those have used the treatment that are called high-lows, which means they are high-interest stories, but they're meant for low-level readers. So if you have a child that, say, is in the 4th or 5th grade, but they're reading at a 1st or 2nd grade level, you introduce the characters that they like, Batman, Superman, what have you, and then you give them a lower reading level so it's accessible to them, and then they can move up.
Okay.
So they're chapter books, but they're written on a lower reading level. And that Capstone does a lot of those, and they're called high-lows.
Okay. So. Okay, well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about 2 other books that I had as a kid that were children's books, but featuring comic characters. But these are from Marvel, so we'll see you in a bit.
You like cheap comic books, right? Well, I'm Professor Allen. And I talk about cheap comic books on the Quarterbin Podcast. In every episode, I'll dissect a single comic from my collection, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for the issue. Forget about $4 new comics that you can read in 4 minutes, or crossover events that can cost $100 to collect. Join me in the Quarterbin, where even bad comics are a bargain, and good ones are a steal. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Visit us at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search Relatively Geeky or Quarterbin Podcast in iTunes. I guarantee it'll be worth every penny.
Okay, we're back, and now we're going to talk about some books that Marvel put out. And actually, you know, Marvel obviously had books through Golden Books and things like that, like I said. But in the 80s, they actually had their own line of Marvel books. That was they went into book publishing. And so they put out paperbacks, like black and white paperback reprints of comics. And coloring books, which I think we touched on those, some of the Secret Wars coloring books when we had Brian Hyler on here. And they also did just some children's storybooks. And actually, these two I picked up at Eastside Pharmacy here in Cynthiana, which is where I got the vast majority of my comics growing up, so it was kind of neat.
Well, it's literally right up the street from you.
Right, it was literally right up the street from my house. And as I recall, these were actually not in with the books. There was an aisle that had rack toys, and it had, you know, like, you know, cap guns and balsa wood airplanes and all the stuff that's in Brian's Rack Toys book, which, by the way, we've told you before, go out and buy that book. It's awesome. And Brian Hyler's book. And this was, you know, these were sitting on a shelf, you know, with coloring books and things like that. So these were called Marvel Books Big Looker Storybooks. So that was obviously them trying to kind of create their own little niche there. So the first one we got is a Spider-Man book. It's The Amazing Spider-Man, The Big Top Mystery, by David Anthony Kraft, Marie Severin, and Earl Norum. Peter Parker attends a circus performance with his Aunt May. The circus owner and retired star, Brad Steele, is an old friend of May's. Peter's spider sense detects trouble, so he changes into Spider-Man to see what is amiss. During the opening parade, one of the elephants goes on a rampage. Spidey finds a dart embedded in the elephant. Someone was trying to disrupt the circus. Brad Steele tells Spidey of how he was trying to sell the circus to make a future for his acrobat grandson, Bobby. Steele fears someone is out to ruin him, and he'll never be able to sell the failing circus. Spidey decides to find the culprit, and the next day more trouble occurs. An ultrasonic whistle sets all of the animals on edge, including an agitated lion, that Spidey stops before he has a chance to maul a clown. At the performance later that night, Bobby's trapeze line is cut, and Spidey comes to the rescue. He also nabs the saboteur, the same clown he saved from the lion. The nameless clown only wanted to stop the circus from being sold. In some ways, his scheme worked, as all the publicity had made the circus very popular again, with bookings good through the next 5 years. Spidey swings away to the cheers of the grateful circus folk. David Anthony Kraft wrote many titles for Marvel in the late 70s and early 80s, including a long run on the Defenders. And at the time this was being published, he'd just written a lengthy run of World's Finest at DC. A lot of comics fans would know him from his own magazine he put out called David Anthony Kraft's Comic Interview. And that magazine ran from 1983 to 1995. Marie Severn, as we said, was a mainstay of the Marvel bullpen. She had done coloring work for EC Comics and then Marvel. And then she ended up doing a lot of just pencil artwork. So I don't know if she did layouts on this or full pencils, but Earl Norum did painted artwork, just gorgeous painted artwork.
I mean, and you got to say that about this book and also the other book as well. The artwork that's featured, I mean, it's beautiful. It really is.
That's why I bought it. I mean, to be honest, I was a little beyond these when they came out because I would have been about 9 or 10.
Right.
And I mean, they weren't, I mean, you know, I wasn't too far beyond them. But, I mean, obviously I could read like a regular book at that point, like a chapter book.
Right.
But the artwork's why I bought it, because back then you just did not, in the days before Alex Ross, you just did not see superheroes painted very often.
Mm-hmm.
Norm was a mainstay in commercial and magazine art, and he specialized in painted covers for all sorts of magazines. My dad's got some old Western magazines that Charlton published that have covers by Earl Norum. I mean, he did a lot of Marvel magazine covers for their magazine line in the 70s up through the 80s. I recognized his artwork from all the He-Man work he did. There was a He-Man and the Masters of the Universe magazine that was out around this time, and he did like the painted covers and the posters that came with it, and also did a lot of other He-Man stuff. In fact, there's a book that's coming out. I think it was already out in a limited release, but it's coming out in a wide release called The Art of the Masters of the Universe.
Oh, okay.
And his He-Man's on the cover.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, he's just a phenomenal artist. There's a nice two-page recap of Spidey's origin at the beginning of this, mm-hmm. and it's really well done. And Norm even draws Peter, or paints Peter with his glasses on, which, you know, a lot of times we'll leave that out if it, you know, in the origin flashbacks. You know, the story, it's pretty basic. I mean, we're not going to pick these things apart. They're written for kids.
Right. I mean, we were talking about this morning. You know, it's a basic kind of Scooby-Doo plot.
Right, exactly. You know. Yeah, I think it's even kind of similar to the ghost clown and all that stuff episode of Scooby-Doo. You know, it doesn't violate Spidey continuity, but it gets the job done, and it's a story for kids. One thing that does kind of stand out to me is the clown. He's willing to kill the kid.
He cut the line, you know, of this little kid. He's 9 years old, and he's going to kill him just so the circus doesn't go away.
Right, yeah. So,
and then it's okay. What kills me is you have the owner of the circus come up to the clown as they're getting ready to lead him away and put a comforting hand on the clown and say, "I hope you realize you did something bad." I'm just like, he just tried to kill your grandson, and you're giving him a comforting arm? What the crap?
Yeah, it's a little... That was a little extreme, I think, for the try to kill him. If he'd done something that accidentally almost killed him. But, I mean, he cut the line. I mean, this is almost the Flying Graysons here, people.
Yeah, I mean.
So, yeah, I thought that was a little, I've always thought that was a little extreme. But other than that, you know, I mean, it's a cute story. And the artwork is just freaking gorgeous. It's, mm-hmm. you know, in the years after your favorite Nicholas Hammond Spider-Man TV show. She's shivering over here.
Shuddering with, oh my goodness.
Yeah. We didn't get live action Spider-Man, you know, so a painting, really well done paintings like this are as close as you're going to get.
Right.
Know, seeing them as real people. So this exact same team also did a Fantastic Four book that I have, and they may have done others. I'm sure they did. I just really don't know, but they did one with the FF, and that is Fantastic Four, The Island of Danger. You want to take this one?
Sure. With Reed occupied with his experiments and Johnny and Ben squabbling, Sue Richards suggests a South Seas vacation. Nice to know they got money for that.
Yeah.
Arriving on a small island, the Fantastic Four are surprised to find the natives know about them and give them a hero's welcome. They soon earn it by stopping a giant tidal wave from crashing into the island. Their grateful chief gifts Sue with a giant pearl necklace. The pearls come from large oysters deep on the ocean floor and are guarded by a giant octopus. The Fantastic Four enjoy some nice recreational time on the island, including scuba diving for Reed, Sue, and Johnny. The youngest member of the team soon finds those giant oysters and their guardian. Unable to flame on, Johnny is helpless in the monster's grip. Reed manages to save Sue, who heads toward the surface to warn Ben of the danger. The ever-loving blue-eyed thing comes to the rescue and clobbers the octopus, saving his friends. For his act of bravery, Ben is named Honorary Chief of the Island, before a sad Fantastic Four must leave their new friends behind and head home.
Yeah, this story is even more basic than the other one, really. I mean, because it's basically just a way for the Fantastic Four to show off their powers,
mm-hmm.
more or less, which, you know... And in fact, you know, we get a nice recap at the beginning of their origin. And it's really weird because Ben Grimm, when they show Ben Grimm as a human, he looks like almost dead on Michael Bailey Smith, who played Ben in the aborted Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He looks like just like that guy. It's kind of weird. You know, you get the ship and them in their astronaut outfits while they're changing and everything, so that's cool. And then you also get 2 pages of them showing off their powers, just in case anybody wasn't familiar with them and, you know, tried to forget.
Had been living under a rock.
Tried to forget the cartoon with Herbie the Robot, you know. It's funny because, of course, the artwork's gorgeous. It's Earl Norm again. Marie Severin and Earl Norm. And David Anthony Kraft wrote this one, as we said. But Johnny is shown playing the old Activision Spider-Man game for the Atari. I mean... That's awesome. I had that game. I loved that game. It was a pain in the neck because you get up to the top and the Green Goblin had the bomb. It would always blow up. The only sucky part about it is, and I don't know if I may have mentioned this on the show before. I don't know. I love my mother, God rest her soul, but she read in Woman's Day or one of them mom magazines that video games can burn a pattern into your TV. And of course they actually can, but if you don't leave them on one screen forever, then they won't.
Right, right.
But she was adamant that when we got the Atari, that don't plug it into our good TV. Plug it into the black and white TV in your sister's room. And I'm like, oh, great. So I played all my Atari games on black and white TV.
You never got to play them in color?
Not the Atari games. Nope.
Aww.
No. I played
them. You mean there's one instance where your mother didn't spoil you and give you what you wanted?
Exactly, yeah.
You poor baby. Aww.
Bitter much?
All I'm going to say... You know I loved your mother, but she spoiled you. Good heavens. I had my work cut out for me when I got you.
That's right. But anyway, so I never saw Spider-Man in his proper red and blues. He was all in different shades of gray. And when I got my Nintendo, you know, for years I basically had the Atari and kind of got tired of it. And they kind of quit making games for it. It just kind of fell out of favor. And then there was like a gap of several years in between the heyday of Atari and then the heyday of 8-bit Nintendo. And so when I got the Nintendo, I begged and begged and begged, don't let me plug it up to the real TV, the big TV. So, you know, I got to play Nintendo in color, but not the Atari. But,
oh.
But anyway, Johnny is shown playing that game, which I think is awesome. When they stop the tidal wave, Ben uses the Hulk's patented thunderclap move where he, you know, slaps his hands together
yeah.
and stops the wave. So that's cool.
Now, I've always wondered about this. When you see a superhero do this, whether it be, you know, the Thing or the Hulk or Superman, I've seen Superman do this too.
What?
The noise that they create by doing that to do whatever, doesn't that also deafen any of the people that are in the immediate vicinity?
I was kind of wondering that myself, yeah.
I mean, you know, because...
Yeah.
And especially the people that are, like, right around him, I mean...
I have a no price. Because you just see Ben when he does it, the Thing when he does it. Sue put a force field around him when he did it.
But then if she put a force field around him when he did it, wouldn't it just be contained and it wouldn't go out?
No, he put it around, she put it around herself, Reed, and Johnny. That's my no price. Because they were the only ones around. That's my no price, because you don't see what they're doing when he does it, because it's a storybook.
I mean, even not just for this story, but otherwise, I mean...
Well, the Hulk doesn't care if he deafens somebody, but good point with Superman and the Thing, you know.
I'm just saying, you know, there's my logic last moment of the day.
You bring out logic last when we're talking about children's storybooks.
Uh-huh.
I got to work on that logic last segment or something. You know, one thing I like about this is that Kraft has the Fantastic Four's voices down. You know, that he nails the Thing and Johnny when they're squabbling, and he even throws in an Aunt Petunia reference.
Right, I caught that. That was cute.
Yeah. The FF are depicted in their classic blue and black uniforms, even though at this point John Byrne had them in their inverted black and white uniforms, but I guess Spider-Man wasn't in his black outfit either, which was around this time. And speaking of which, both of these books on the back feature the Secret Wars logo, and they don't tie into the concept anyway, but I think at that point, anything Marvel put out in from 84 to 85, they slapped Marvel Superhero Secret Wars on. That was just their, like DC slapped Superpowers on everything, they slapped Secret Wars on everything, even though Secret Wars was more concept-y, you know.
I wonder what the turnaround time was from the point that they hired the art writing team versus to when it actually saw print.
Yeah, that's a good point, especially where it was painted.
I mean, you know, I was just thinking about that because I know the shortest publishing schedule I know of, there is a Christian book company that she is given 6 weeks to write a novel of 300 pages. And
dang.
She has a 6-week writing time,
yeah,
a 2-month editing time, and 2 months before it hits the shelf.
Wow.
And that is, and she said that's typical for that publishing company. So you're talking about every 4 to 6 months turning over a new book.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't know how fast Earl Norum painted, but...
Right. But, you know, I just wonder what the time frame was.
The fact that he was so prolific tells me that he could paint pretty quick, especially if he was working from somebody else's pencils or layouts. Like I said, I'm not sure what Marie Severin did on this, and if somebody knows and says, oh, Marie Severin actually drew the whole thing and he just painted over top of it, then, you know, let us know, you know. I mean, I really don't know. I couldn't find out a whole lot about these specifically. That's the thing. These aren't, you know, the history of books like this aren't really cataloged the way comics are.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's not, you know, magazines like Back Issue and stuff do touch on things like this sometimes. But, you know, in general, they're not, which is one reason I wanted to kind of touch upon them, because I think it's something that,
there is some beautiful artwork found in children's books.
Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, not just superhero stuff.
No.
But, you know, just for the audience of this show, you know, all two of you, I think, like I said, you know, we all picked up our love of comics and superheroes somewhere. So, you know, it might have been from, you know, you might have watched the old George Reeves TV show of Superman. You might have picked up a coloring book just because it looked cool, and then you were introduced to Batman or Spider-Man, or, you know, you might have picked up a comic book. You know, back then it was easy to pick up a comic book on a newsstand. But, you know, we all met them at different places in different ways. Which is why I'm one of these people that is adamant about the fact that don't give people a hard time that just like the movies that are out, that just like the TV shows that are on. You know, don't exclude them. Don't be a, you know, just because you were pantsed as a kid, you know, for loving comic books. Don't spread the hate and hate people that just like comics for, you know, liking them from a different medium.
There's room for everybody at the comic book table.
That's right. That's right. And if you met them through a storybook, and if you just had these books when you were a kid and really loved, like you just had this Fantastic Four book and really loved this Fantastic Four book and never read another, never read a Fantastic Four comic, missed the 90s TV series, but you were sitting in a theater and they showed the trailer for the 2000 whatever Fantastic Four movie, the first one, you're like, hey, cool, Fantastic Four, I had a book of them when I was a kid, and you went and saw the movie, who cares? You know,
right. So
you like the Fantastic Four, you know, and you can say what you want about those movies, but, you know, that's fine. And, you know, you don't have to know the who Jack, you know, Jess Lee and Kirby and John Byrne and all these people, you know, you can be a fan of some of something and not, you know, have a cataloged history of it in your brain. But then I get
off. You're just weird, but get off your soapbox.
I'm off my soapbox. So that'll do it. Hope you enjoyed it. And like I said, there's plenty of children.
Oh, I will say one thing about this book.
What?
I was upset for the octopus.
The octopus. Yeah.
I mean, that's not very nice. The octopus is hanging out in the ocean doing his thing, and he gets beat up for taking care of his own property.
Right, right. Well, I guess the pearls weren't really his property, but yeah, they were in his
domain,
and yeah, that's true.
And he got beat up. That's not very nice.
Yeah, that's kind of that probably isn't the type of thing you'd see today. I mean, there's probably you know, there'd be more of a. You know, there's more of an idea. Everybody that nobody wants to offend people who are animal lovers, and
right.
And we're all a little more sensitive about things like that. So it probably wouldn't happen today. You know, they'd be having if they were in the DC universe, Aquaman would be stopping by and having a talk to him. Namor doesn't care; he's stuck on himself. But you know, Aquaman.
Oh, he might stop by so he could go mack on Sue.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Maybe she'll wear her, you know, her four window outfit for him when she comes back.
Oh my.
We were trying to keep this episode clean. We better quit.
Okay.
So, well, that'll do it for this time. Thanks everybody for listening. Next time, well, I don't know exactly. We're going to try to keep it. We're not going to tell you as much as we used to. We're going to keep it, kind of keep it, try to keep it fresh and, you know, keep
it. Basically, it goes, we're working on it. We'll get you something.
Yeah, we'll
it'll be good.
Yeah, we've got a bunch of stuff in the pipeline. We've got ideas. We've got things we're working on. We've got guests that are
we're working on confirmation.
The confirmation of guests that
and
might.
Scheduling
and stop by and things like that. So, just come back in 2 weeks and we'll chat again. So, see ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The fictional characters and events mentioned in this show are trademark and copyright their respective owners. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their owners, and we mean no infringement by either. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geek Cast.